Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, connecting Dia de los Muertos imagery to the fight for civil rights among Mexican Americans.
And celebrating the artisanal grain movement that began here in Arizona. But first, it is time for the Friday News Cap and some voices from the news this week.
I will not stand by as Arizona families go hungry. Arizonans should not ever be used as a bargaining chip while Donald Trump plays politics.
Food banks around the state are coping as well as they can, I think, given what is around the corner for them, which is a massive increase in the people that they serve.
Does that end up creating the banter saying, okay, now the Democrats in the Senate want to issue something else and continue this sort of dance going back and forth?
We allocated $1.8 million to provide emergency assistance. I know it's not enough. We're asking Arizonans to show up for their community like they always do. I know that's not enough. The president could end this right now.
They should swear her in a pro forma session, as has been done before and as she's asking for. I don't understand why this is an issue at all.
He's got the power to cut that funding, and we must avoid an $800 million cut to our budget for our students. And I'm not sure that's sinking in, and I'm upset about it.
And joining me to talk about the impending end of federal food assistance, controversy over the location of a state GOP meeting, and more are Matthew Benson of Veritas. Matt, good morning.
Happy Halloween, Mark.
Happy Halloween to you. And Stacey Pearson of Lumen Strategy. Stacey, good morning to
you. Good morning.
I'll point out that none of the three of us are in costume, although I guess you guys could say you're dressed as political consultants, and I guess I'm just a public radio person. So there you go.
Indeed.
So we saw this week, and actually yesterday, a federal judge on the East Coast said that it seemed likely that she might get involved, Stacey, in this SNAP controversy, the Supplemental Nutrition Program. Basically, the federal government, the Trump administration, has said we are not going to fill the debit cards that food stamp recipients use to buy food come November 1st, come tomorrow. And a number of states, including Arizona, said, no, that's not OK. You have this contingency fund that you should be using. So, like, it seems, though, that even if the judge says you have to do this, A, there are appeals, and B, it seems like logistically there is some lag time between like actually filling the cards and letting folks use them to buy groceries. So what does that mean for Arizonans here?
Oh, for Arizonans here, as we just heard on some of those clips, there is going to be a major run on the food banks. And I want to, again, underscore who we're talking about here. We're talking about families of three that make less than $36,000 a year. We're talking about folks that are making minimum wage, that are working as gig workers. We're talking about Amazon in Arizona having the largest number of its gig workers also qualifying for food assistance. So the guy dropping off your packages this morning is the guy that's not going to have food tomorrow. I mean, this is absolutely terrifying. And the examples we're going to see on the news are foster families, are people that have signed a contract with the state to take care of babies who do not have parental guardianships or have parental guardians. They're not going to have funding for formula tomorrow.
Yeah, Matt, we've been hearing from food banks. We spoke with someone from the Food Bank Association earlier this week. This seems like a pretty significant concern that they have, especially like in the next, let's say, week or two. Even if this gets resolved legally, there's going to be some lag time here.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're talking about 900,000 Arizonans that qualify for this program. So beginning November 1, you know, their EBT cards will not be filled in order to go out and purchase the food and groceries that they need. And everything that Stacey said is true. And that's why I think this is creating the political necessity that this logjam, this political logjam, is going to get resolved, I believe, in the coming week. I think the political risks for both parties have become so high that that you're going to see this get resolved in a matter of days.
How do you see it getting resolved? Like who – how do the negotiations happen?
That's a good question. Whether you end up with a clean CR or maybe a very short-term CR that allows federal funding to begin to flow again, food stamps and other critical programs to be funded while negotiations on larger ticket items like the healthcare subsidies continue, I think that's probably the most realistic option at this point. But I do think that you're going to see that resolved very quickly.
What do you think, Stacey? Is this the political issue that gets the sides to the table?
So I think we'll see a combination of issues that bring people to the table. We got our new insurance rates for the small business that I own that start at the first of the year. They're up about 28%. I mean, this is significant. And so, you know, as folks are re-upping insurance, health insurance for next year, I think the sticker shock is going to be important. And this starts now. And certainly kids, the cuts in after school programs, where are 7-year-olds going to go? I mean, we're talking about making it extraordinarily difficult to be poor, having difficulty feeding your family, having difficulty getting after school care or before school care or transportation. I mean, we are punishing the working poor that keep this country running in a way that we haven't seen since the Gilded Age. And I think at some point people are going to get really, really pissed off that there are millions, hundreds of millions of dollars going to a new ballroom and the Amazon drivers are hungry.
Well, Matt, so you mentioned we've been talking about SNAP and Stacey just brought up the Affordable Care Act premiums. Open enrollment, of course, begins tomorrow as well. And this is the main issue that Senate Democrats have said they're holding out for because premiums are expected to go up and the subsidies are going away. So that means there have been some estimates that, you know, policies could be 2 or 3 times as expensive for the same coverage for a lot of folks. Does it have to get to the point where like, sort of, I hate this phrase, but everyday Americans are being affected to get the politicians together and say, look, guys, we got to figure this out.
Yeah. I think some of what's going on right now are the COVID era subsidies and, mm-hmm. and extras that were funded that Republicans feel like at this point, look, we're 6 years out from COVID. Do these enhanced funding programs have to continue in perpetuity? Like, are they just going to continue forever? So I think there is a good faith argument to be made that some of these things should phase out post-pandemic. But this is, of course, the conundrum. You know, when you begin funding things, you start a new program, it's very difficult to ever take it away. And so, both parties like to spend. And that's why our deficit and our debt are what they are.
Well, but Matt, that also kind of raises the question that if there are enough, for example, U.S. senators who believe that, who say it's been long enough, why do we need to keep doing this? It seems hard to believe that enough Democrats would vote to reopen the government if they don't think they're going to get this thing that they've been holding out for.
Well, and that therein is the problem. That's why we're in this having this conversation, 30 days in. Because of that exact dynamic, which gets at the other thing we have not brought up yet, which is the 60-vote threshold to approve something in the Senate, and the president now, as of the last 24 hours, arguing that the Senate should go with the nuclear option, eliminate the 60-vote threshold, and there's talk about political risks down the road. I mean, Democrats wanted to do this not so long ago. Now the Republicans are talking about, or at least the president is, huge political ramifications if they pull that ripcord.
Yeah, I mean, how much chaos does that throw sort of the political calculation in if, and we don't know if they're going to, of course, but if the Senate Republicans say we're done with the filibuster?
Well, I'm channeling my inner Senator Sinema here, but the most deliberative body in the world is the United States Senate, and to get 10 votes from the other team in a closely divided chamber like we have now requires compromise, and those compromises ensure policy lasts beyond so-and-so's term from Texas. This typically secured better policy for the country. It's a little terrifying to have the United States Senate on the same whiplash, level of whiplash that we see out of the House. And so I think it's extraordinarily dangerous. And what the Democrats are asking for is really reasonable. We're talking about continuing health care coverage for millions of Americans and extending benefits now, food, nutrition benefits, to the folks that need it most, that are that again are our lowest wage workers. These are folks that every day are taking care of our kids. They're my mom's nursing assistants. They're keeping my hospice mother alive. I mean, these are folks that are working their tails off that need help. So either raise wages or provide subsidies, but one of the two has to happen. And wages have not caught up in decades.
Stacey, one of the other outcomes of the shutdown is that Adelita Grijalva still is not sworn in as a member of Congress. She's now set a record that I'm guessing that none of us really knew existed before, which is the longest time from a special election to being sworn in. It's about a month now that she's not been sworn in. And House Speaker Mike Johnson says that he will not swear her in until the government is reopened. This week, though, we saw a Republican member of Congress from California say she should just be sworn in. Like, why is this an issue? Does that change the narrative at all?
Well, if you believe the conspiracy theories that this is tied to the Epstein case, you know, we've got that to contend with. What it does do is show how dysfunctional the chamber is, the United States House of Representatives, and it sets a precedent for people to continue to do bad things. I mean, this is not a good place to start. And Grijalva won overwhelmingly. She's replacing her father. She needs to be installed as a member of Congress. And we saw what happened when we held up Supreme Court nominations and hearings in the Obama administration. And this is really dangerous.
Matt, do you think this makes any difference to have one Republican member of Congress say she should be sworn in?
No, I don't. But I do believe she should be sworn in. This is a bad precedent to set, and I suspect you'll see, you know, it's just a race to the bottom. You know, now that this is happening, you'll see it likely happen in the not too distant future when Democrats are in control of the House. You may see them utilize the same tactic, and it's similar to the filibuster. I mean, the argument the president's making about eliminating the filibuster is that if we don't do it, the Democrats will. And so around and around we go.
Right. And which is the same argument the Democrats have made, right? If we don't do it, the Republicans will. So to your point, just this big giant merry-go-round, huh?
It speaks to the lack of trust in Washington.
Interesting. All right. Matthew Benson, Stacey Pearson. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guests this week are Stacey Pearson of Lumen Strategies and Matthew Benson of Veritas. Matt, let's talk a little bit about a geographical controversy, I guess you could call it, within the state Republican Party. Gina Swoboda, the chair, who is, of course, also now running for Congress, has said that she will step down after the January meeting. But the location of that January meeting is not sitting well with at least one member of the party. State Senator Jake Hoffman is unhappy that it's being held outside of Maricopa County. He's saying that Chair Swoboda is trying to depress turnout and the vote, I suspect. What exactly is going on here? I don't even know what to ask, but what is going on here?
I mean, Chairwoman Swoboda wants to have the state committee meeting in Yavapai County, in the Prescott Valley area. It has been held in Maricopa County for a long time now. Rural precinct committee people have been expressing for a long time, hey, we're tired of having to drive to Phoenix every time. Can we have it closer? Can we have it in one of the out counties? Can we have a, you know, rural meeting? And so, you know, the state party says, look, we've made a promise that we would do this in Prescott, which happens to be like the virtual center of the state.
Yeah. And a pretty big Republican stronghold, too.
Yavapai County absolutely is a Republican stronghold. Makes a lot of sense to have it there. And so, that's what they're going to have. That's what they're going to do. But of course, this is all about politics because, you know, for Senator Hoffman and Tyler Boyer with Turning Point and other folks, they feel like they're going to get more of their precinct committee people who tend to be concentrated in Maricopa County if the meeting is held in Phoenix as opposed to in Prescott.
So the thinking is that people in Maricopa County just aren't willing to drive a couple hours to go to their meeting?
Well, I guess we're going to find out.
Is this in some way, Stacey, a test of the sort of the turning point MAGA wing of the party to see, like, if they can get this meeting moved and if they can get their people to Prescott?
I'm just really excited it's not the Democrats fighting over meeting locations right now. High five, not us at the moment. I do think, look, Turning Point is busing people in from Texas to go knock on doors in Mesa. So if they're not able to get their precinct committee people 90 minutes from where we're sitting right now in this studio, they've got bigger problems. And so I think a lot of this is just a personality conflict that has bubbled up to the surface where we're talking about it here.
And what we haven't talked about, by the way, is what's going to happen at that meeting, which is, you know, that's where they're going to be selecting a new party chair.
Exactly.
So the stakes are high. Gina Swoboda has already announced she's stepping down as of January to run for Congress over in CD1. And so that position is going to be available. And the knives are out. You know, there's a lot of political interest in who's going to take that position, the power and authority that comes with it.
Well, and it's interesting, Matt, because obviously we've seen over the past several months that, you know, the Jake Hoffmans of the world are not thrilled with Gina Swoboda and
not
her leadership.
Thrilled. That's
I'm trying to be polite.
Yeah.
They're unhappy. They're despondent over it.
Sure.
So I guess the question is, like, do we have a sense of who they might want instead? Because as you say, this is going to be an open position. Presumably the Turning Point folks are going to have a candidate.
Well, 100% they'll have a candidate. I'm not sure who they're going to throw in behind. But they'll have a candidate that the word will get out on who their person is. Kelly Ward previously held the chairwoman spot. Gina Swoboda has kind of taken the party in a little different direction, at least in terms of the party staying out of contested primaries. I think that you'll certainly see Turning Point make a play for that position. They've wanted to kind of take over the state party for quite some time now, and this is their chance.
I mean, Stacey, I wonder, as are Democrats just like popping popcorn and waiting to see what unfolds here? Maybe
you guys
hoping
have
for
own
another
problems
Kelly.
Over there.
How are we? What? How do I describe this? We're trying not to celebrate too loudly for that point exactly.
It's not been smooth sailing for the Dems this year either.
It's not. But look, we at least don't think chemtrails are an issue like previous chairs of the Republican Party. We also don't think Italian laser beams changed the outcome of the 2020 election. So I actually look forward to a nice tinfoil hat lunatic taking control of the Republican Party again. That's going to
wow.
be fun.
That's the bumper sticker right there,
mm-hmm.
isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is.
So one other thing that we saw this week, guys, the State Board of Education, not something we often talk about on the newscap, but this week a pretty interesting discussion about whether or not to remove language that could be considered, quote unquote, DEI or woke from state teaching standards. Tom Horn is concerned that the state could lose hundreds of millions of dollars from the federal government if they don't do this. And yet the board voted to say, no, let's hold off. Not saying no, not saying yes, but we're going to hold off on this. Matt, does this seem like something that is going to continue to be an issue for at least for the state board, if not in a broader sense across the state?
No, it's going to be – it's an issue at the state board. It's an issue that the universities are running into, as we've seen the Trump administration reaching out to both University of Arizona and Arizona State University on some of these same issues. As Superintendent Horn points out, there's about $800 million in federal funding for K-12 schools in this state that is potentially at risk if the administration feels like the state is violating the order that the president made regarding DEI.
Stacey, do you expect this to continue to be an issue as well?
So what I expect is us to remind folks, is Democrats in particular, to remind folks that, you know what else is almost $1 billion? The voucher nightmare that the state is in the middle of. So we want to eliminate language that ensures people are treated fairly regardless of their race, their religion, et cetera. In the meantime, Tom Horn's own agency is automatically approving expenses like lingerie and jet skis and gym memberships that most average Arizonans can't afford. So it is so hollow to say we need to fix this. But go ahead. We're going to continue to approve a voucher program that's decimating the public school funding system.
Well, what's interesting about that, Matt, is that Tom Horn, as we know, is facing a primary challenge in his reelection bid next year from the right, from State Treasurer Kimberly Yee. And her main issue, at least one of them, is that Horn is not like lax enough. He's not pro ESAs enough. So I wonder if this kind of issue becomes, and I'm not suggesting that Horn does not like legitimately care about this, does not sincerely believe in this, but I also wonder if this issue sort of becomes a campaign talking point for him.
No, it's a no-brainer for the superintendent. I mean to come out basically saying, look, I'm here to enforce President Trump's order to, I mean, DEI and related concepts, this will be a surprise to both of you. They poll very poorly in a Republican primary.
Really?
And so to come out as the anti-DEI candidate is just a no-brainer for Horn. And frankly, this whole issue, I mean, the fact that it is going to continue and he gets to be the voice on this, it's a stroke of good luck for him.
Well, does this in any way, do you think, blunt the criticism he's getting on ESAs?
I appreciate Stacey bringing this up. But they are very separate and distinct issues, and I don't see them overlapping.
Even politically, though, like he's getting criticism for not being pro ESA enough. Can he sort of like say, okay, but like look at this I'm doing. Like you also care about this, and I'm very strong on this.
100%. I mean, he's going to talk about. He would have talked about this issue no matter what in the course of this election, but this just gives him more and more opportunity to.
And Stacey, I mean, so we had the conventional wisdom had been that the GOP primary for superintendent would be mostly about ESAs. Is it now going to be mostly about ESAs and diversity in schools?
Oh, who they're going to go back to transgender bathrooms. I mean, we're going to see the entire Republican playbook get rolled out on this one. They're going to be anti-trans children. It's going to be rewriting of Columbus Day versus Indigenous Peoples Day. I mean, we're going to go straight down the list. And so I think folks just need to strap in because it's going to be a wild ride on the education side.
Meanwhile, who's running on the Democrat side?
Oh, that's a good question. Oh, Matt. Details.
Wow. Okay. So, guys, we have about a minute left. Of course, we started by wishing each other a happy Halloween. So I've got to ask, what candy are you – like, are you really, like, digging for, Matt?
Oh, the 100 grand. 100%. Those are the best. So, yeah.
What about it is so appealing to you? Because it's sort of a deep cut in candy.
It's the caramel. It's the chocolate. It's the crunchy. It's perfect. Okay. Still, it's delightful.
All right. So if you have any extra 100 grand bars, Matthew Benson will take them. Stacey, how about you?
Oh, I'm all a Kit Kat all the time.
Kit Kat. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Kit Kats.
Okay. Give me a break, huh?
Yeah, it is. It is. They're always in my fridge.
All right. Well, so anybody trick-or-treating in your neighborhoods, and we're not going to divulge where you live, but, you know, if you have any of these, feel free to sort of reverse trick-or-treat, hand them to the kind people at the houses.
I'll take a high noon also.
That's a different kind of Halloween, I think. All right. Matthew Benson, Stacey Bierson, thank you so much, you both, for coming in. Happy Halloween.
Thank you.
Happy Halloween.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the dynamic relationship between the evolution of Chicano art and Dia de los Muertos.
But first, there are festivals of all kinds all over the valley these days, from tacos to pizza to music to crafts. There's a fest for just about everything. But our next guest is here to tell you about a brand new festival coming up this weekend about one of my very favorite things. Bread. Emma Zimmerman is the co-owner and founder of Hayden Flour Mills. She and her dad brought back the historic mill 13 years ago, growing and milling heritage Arizona grains and making all kinds of interesting flours, oats, grains, and wheats from it. Today, the movement they started here is everywhere, and Breadfest will celebrate it. They're holding it at Barrio Bagel and Slice in Gilbert, a new operation opened by famed Tucson baker Don Guerra. They're even holding a sourdough competition. I spoke with Zimmerman more about it all and why her dad got into milling to begin with.
He was really getting into sourdough baking, seeing how flour, being the main ingredient, had kind of lost its flavor and its character. So he started milling at home, got really into stone milling, then that led to growing local grains, finding all these heritage grains that had so much flavor and interest and color and character. And yeah, that was 13 years ago. Now we have all these local chefs, local bakers, just a brand new movement
right.
of grain here.
And I think movement is the right word for it, because in the last almost 15 years now that you've been doing this, like, this is not that out of the ordinary anymore, I guess. Like, you were the first ones probably in the area, at least, to reopen an old mill and, like, really do this the old-fashioned way. But lots of people are doing this now. It sounds like it's spread.
Yes. Yes. Every state now has their local grain movement, their artisanal mills. So that's so encouraging. And even our customers have gotten so sophisticated. They know the names of these grains. They're asking for them, like, oh, do you have a spelt? Do you have einkorn? Names that people didn't know about, you know, when we started. So I just feel so encouraged with how much progress we've made, how many local bakers are using mm-hmm. local grains and are excited and aren't afraid. When we first started, it was a real sell on, like, just give it a try. Maybe add a little bit to your bread. And now, you know, like I said, they're asking for them. They're seeing that difference of, like, a conventional industrial flour being a little tasteless, a little boring, mm-hmm. and having fun adding these grains.
People are definitely into bread.
Yes.
So you're throwing the first ever Bread Fest, a great name for it, by the way. And it's sort of supposed to be, you know, obviously a celebration of bread, but, you know, a small town festival. What do you have planned here?
Yes. So the idea kind of came from customers coming into our store, showing us pictures of their loaves of bread. You know, like, they're their children.
They're proud.
They're proud. I was like, okay, when you make a loaf of sourdough bread at home, it is so magical and you're so proud of yourself. Let's give our customers a place to show off their loaves of breads in this very wholesome kind of retro state fair-esque festival.
Okay.
So there will be this sourdough competition for home bakers. We have also a cottage baker category, and it's going to be just a lot of eating of bread. We have a local baker from Wickenburg making a butter sculpture for us. It's kind of a showpiece.
It sounds like the Iowa State Fair with a butter cow. I get
yes,
what you're going
there
for.
There will be okay, a butter okay. cow. A wheat craft for kids. So very simple, you know, just back to basics, like gathering the community to celebrate how far we've come with local grains. Mm-hmm. All the amazing bakers we have here in Arizona that we didn't have, you know, 13 years ago.
Yeah.
The sourdough competition is going to be, you know, friendly competition.
Like, but someone's going to want to win it, I'm sure.
Yes, but so, still try your best. Yeah.
I mean, like, tell us about that a little more, because I know during the pandemic, a lot of people talked about their sourdough bread and their starters. But this is, like, sparked, it seems like, a whole culture of people who are very into their sourdoughs, whether they're baking them at home or not.
Yes.
So, I mean, are you hearing from people excited to enter this?
People, the home baker category sold out so quickly. Do you bake at all?
No, not really.
Okay, well, yeah. So it's like you cross over. Once you have a sourdough starter, you get into it. You just can't help it. It's so addicting. It's so amazing to just see this thing you grow on your counter turn into these loaves of bread that you're just like, yeah, you just – you can't stop.
You can't stop.
So it is for those, yeah, those really – those breadheads, the people that are just really into their hobby, and it's – they can come to Breadfest and just be their nerdy bread selves with all the other people that love bread.
Did you just say breadheads?
Yes.
All right. That's a new one I'm going to have to use. Okay. And it's also in partnership with or hosted by sort of a very famous Arizona baker, Don Guerra, who used to be based in Tucson, has a new place in Gilbert. Tell us about this.
Yes. So Breadfest is going to be hosted at Don Guerra's Barrio Bagel and Slice in Gilbert. And he has a beautiful new drive-through restaurant there, and it's going to be set up in his parking lot, just kind of like a farmer's market type festival. And so we're really lucky that he was excited to host, and he's a big user of local grains. Mm-hmm. He's been really important in the local grain economy and such a champion of local grains. So,
right.
Of course, it makes sense that we would be partnering with him.
Yeah. I mean, he's a James Beard Award-winning baker and of bread. Like, he's known for bread. He's not making, like, French pastries, right? Talk a little bit about the fact that that exists today. I mean, like, you think about bread and it seems relatively basic to folks, but this is – he's taking it to a whole different level.
Yes. It's amazing what he's done. And again, using local grains and really kind of adapting to, okay, what can we grow in Arizona? Because we can't grow all the grains, but grains that are desert adapted, use less water to grow. And he's kind of been inspired by that. So it's been this great like synergy with him to see what he takes from our mill and then turns it into, I mean, he probably has a menu of 15 different breads and they're all just unique. And I'll just go through different phases where I'm like, oh, the einkorn miche, like it's so amazing. And he does a cheddar chiltepin fugas. A Sonoran sourdough.
You're making me hungry.
A chocolate cherry. I know. I have his menu memorized. So, but yeah, he's just really taken – it's just the way that he shows off the Arizona grains is so accessible too. Like they are beautiful works of art for sure, but they're really accessible as well. He's been really generous too as a educator around sourdough. So he does classes. You can always show up at his restaurant or bakery – and he'll give you some of his sourdough starter, which I think is really fun to get people hooked at baking at home. So
that's quite a starter to get gifted with. Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's interesting. You mentioned something there about how you can't grow every heritage grain in Arizona. Have you seen sort of the rising heat in the valley, the climate change impacts hit your industry as well?
Yes, absolutely. We have seen the impact of water on our crops over the years. There's less water for crops, but that's okay because the way we built our business was finding seeds that are desert adapted, use less water to grow, knowing that that was going to become more and more of a problem. When it does rain during our growing season, we're always like, wow, so grateful because sometimes we wouldn't have made it without that rain.
Well, so I wonder in light of that, right? Like it is changing here and you've been growing this for so long as we started the conversation talking about. Where do you see this going in the future? Are you going to be continuing to grow in Arizona? Are you looking for other places to grow? I mean, is this something you feel like, is that going to be something you can continue going forward?
Yes, we are always looking for more farmers to partner with, especially would love to see some young farmers, you know, getting started, coming on board, growing for us. I think Phoenix is just getting started on its potential to really use local grains. And I hope we'll be around for many, many more years. The original Hayden Flour Mills was started in 1874. It did have a brief period where it was, you know, out of business. We restarted it in 2011. And I hope we can, like, just keep going for another century. I don't know. My daughter wants to work for Hayden Flour Mills. So I'm like, okay, at least, you know, until she grows up.
You've got one generation to keep it going. All right, we'll leave it there for now. Breadfest is coming up on November 2nd. That is Emma Zimmerman, the co-owner and co-founder of Hayden Flour Mills, joining us. Emma, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Yes, you're welcome.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. A few years ago, we asked listeners for their best ghost stories. Here is ASU professor Paul Morris.
I'll begin by cautioning you that I don't believe in ghosts. I'm just not a believer in the afterlife. What we have when alive is plenty. But we live in a state filled with ghost stories, and that's to be expected when you have gunfighters, gold miners, old hotels, and of course, old graveyards, places where you'd expect ghosts. But I found stories of ghosts in unexpected places, like our three state universities. Down in Tucson, at the University of Arizona, I heard about Maricopa Hall. Students often hear women arguing and screaming in the middle of the night. Of course, if you spend time on any campus, you'll hear people arguing and screaming just about every night of the week. There's even a haunted fountain over by Old Main. Throughout the years, the fountain, a memorial to 13 students who died in World War I, has had a number of mysterious problems. Maintenance crews complain it overflows and sprays or drains for no apparent reason. I had the same problem in my house until I put in new pipes. I do have the name of a good plumber if they need it. Centennial Hall, the Performing Arts Theater, boasts an apparition, a man with a crazy laugh who plays the piano late at night and randomly moves furniture. This actually describes me on some evenings after I've had a drink. Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff has its Morton Hall, where a ghost makes the lights flicker, pulls blankets off beds, and pulls down posters. Weeping can be heard at night. Remember, this is a college. Weeping is normal. I myself may or may not have wept over a list of German verbs once or twice in my life. So, here's my story. I worked on the campus of Arizona State University. At one point, my office was in the Virginia G. Piper Writer's House, a small cottage by Old Main. I liked the building. It was the home of a college president for some years, and we were told it was the first building on campus to have air conditioning. Poet Robert Frost spent the night there after a reading, and now the creative writing department uses it for classes and offices. It's a peaceful place, and I sometimes found students asleep on the sofa in the living room. The house came with an odd story, though. The wife of a university president lived here with her family. We heard she became an invalid and lived on the second floor until her death. Over the years, students reported seeing a person dressed in a bathrobe and wearing a hat passing by the second-story windows. One semester, I taught a class in the evening that ended at 9 p.m. Afterwards, I'd go upstairs to my office. I'd sometimes work up there for a while, enjoying the quiet. One night, I was answering emails, and then I felt a change in the room. The room suddenly became cold, frigid. Something was different, dramatically different. Almost like I'd been startled and was no longer alone. All the hairs on my arms stood up. Extreme goosebumps. Then the hairs on my neck stood up. The little hair I have on my head stood at attention. Even the hairs on my back raised up. I was in a cold sweat, but I saw nothing in the room. It was a cascade of sensation that wouldn't stop. It was strange, even frightening. What happened next? I am a sensible person. I got up from my desk without pausing to shut down the computer and left the room. I went down the stairs, in a dignified exit, of course, and out of the building. My hair follicles began to relax. I locked the door and went home. Everything was normal again. I did go back to work in that office, but never had that same experience again. Others in the building tell their own stories about odd things that happened. But when I moved to another building, nothing interesting ever happened in my new office, which I kind of like. Happy Halloween to you all.
That one gave me goosebumps. All right. That was Paul Morris. For more spooky stories from KJZZ, head to our website, kjzz.org/spooky-Arizona.
Dia de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead, is this weekend, and a new book and related exhibit showcase how artists introduced imagery associated with the holiday to Americans as part of the Mexican-American Civil Rights Movement. Matthew Sandoval is a teaching professor at Barrett, the Honors College at ASU, and author of Dia de los Muertos, a Chicano Arts Legacy. He joins me to talk more about this. And Matthew, what got you interested in this holiday and how it's seen as a window into the culture?
Yeah, you know, my first encounters with Dia de los Muertos came much later in life, actually. My first encounter with Day of the Dead was in Guatemala. So even though people associate Dia de los Muertos with Mexico specifically, it's a much larger Latin American tradition. So that first opened my eyes that this thing is much bigger than like just the cultural heritage of Mexico. And then I truly, truly got interested in Dia de los Muertos when I began to practice the ancestral tradition of creating an ofrenda every year for Dia de los Muertos. And at that point, it became clear to me that this thing was beyond just a holiday, that this is an opportunity that allows people to heal allows people to deal with grief from losing people. And so once I saw the efficacy of the holiday, I became much more interested in knowing its cultural roots and knowing much more about its history.
What was it like for you finding out about it, as you say, a little bit later in life and at a point, I assume, in your life and maybe even in your career where you could really sort of see the multi-layered nature of it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, part of it is that I became fascinated with it at a much older age, which I found through interviews was pretty common for most Mexican-Americans and most Latinos in the United States, which is to say for many of us, the vast majority of us, this wasn't it wasn't a family tradition.
Wasn't something you did as a kid?
Definitely not something I did as a kid. It was only something I encountered once I was in college and in grad school. And I found that that was really common among other Latinos and Mexican-Americans my age.
Why is it then that so many Hispanics who are of your age didn't grow up with this tradition? Why is it that you only discovered it later in life?
Yeah, part of it has to do with like the origins of Day of the Dead in the United States more generally, which is that it's not something that many Mexican immigrants brought with them as a cultural tradition as they immigrated here to the United States. Part of that had to do with the fact that like in Mexico, Dia de los Muertos is traditionally celebrated in the cemeteries. And for many early migrants here in the United States, their ancestors weren't buried in the cemeteries because they were just recently arrived here. So part of it had to do with the fact that Day of the Dead didn't necessarily take root in U.S. soil. It took a long time for that to happen. And that really begins with the Mexican-American civil rights movement led by Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta. That's when we see the revitalization of a lot of different aspects of Mexican cultural heritage, including in especially Dia de los Muertos.
Yeah, what was the significance of this holiday and sort of the imagery associated with it as part of the larger civil rights movement?
Yeah, so part of the larger project of the Chicano movement or Mexican-American civil rights movement was developing a sense of self-pride in one's culture. And so that paved the way for primarily Mexican-American artists to begin to dive deeper into their heritage, even if it wasn't a family tradition, but to try and recuperate aspects of culture and tradition and heritage that maybe hadn't been celebrated in the United States. And Day of the Dead becomes so gravitational for so many people because Day of the Dead is huge in many parts of Mexico. And so that becomes something that artists begin to recuperate immediately in the 1970s.
I wonder also, the imagery is also very, at least now, recognizable. It's very distinctive, I guess. Like you, when you see one of the visual representations of Dia de los Muertos, you generally have a sense of what it is. I wonder if that sort of helped it take off in this country.
Yeah, for sure. Part of it had to do with the fact that skull and skeleton iconography had been somewhat popular as a form of folk art in Mexico. And Mexico as a country and nation would promote Dia de los Muertos imagery and folk art to American tourists. So U.S. population was generally kind of attuned to the fact that skull and skeleton imagery was central to Mexican national identity. And therefore, that kind of iconography becomes recuperated by Chicano artists because for them, sugar skulls, skulls and skeleton in general don't just mean death, but they also become a symbol for what it means to be Mexican in general.
So we talked a little bit about how the iconography and the idea of Dia de los Muertos was part of the civil rights movement. I'm wondering, like, if there's a balance between introducing particular cultural traditions to a new audience, to new people, as it were, and also being able to retain control of it to some extent. I mean, we hear so much about cultural appropriation and, you know, you can buy sugar skulls and skeleton iconography at places that I'm guessing are not traditional Central or South American type shops. So like
Target, Walmart, Home Depot.
I mean, I wasn't going to name any, but those would be among them. I mean, is there sort of a balance or is there a danger, I guess, in introducing something that is so culturally sensitive in some ways to a broader audience?
Yeah, there's definitely a danger. And we're already experiencing that danger. We have been experiencing that danger for the last at least two decades in the United States specifically, which is to say that mega corporations, conglomerates are starting to take Dia de los Muertos as an opportunity to sell merchandise, make merchandise, sell merchandise. That is starting to ramp up and it's only accelerating here right now. So like Dia de los Muertos objects, which are made in Taiwan or made in China, now populate almost all of the big box retail stores in the autumn. On the other hand, it's always counterbalanced with the fact that most people who organize these Dia de los Muertos community celebrations throughout the United States specifically make them open to the broader community, that it's not just for Latinos, it's not just for Mexican Americans, that it's for the broader community in general. And one of the reasons that they do that is, one, the recognition that this concept of death is like the thing that unites all of us.
Yeah.
It fundamentally does, since that's one thing we will all experience. The other thing is that in many ways, and I'm thinking here about the way Dia de los Muertos has been celebrated in our own Valley community, it's always been multicultural.
So you mentioned that one of the ways that you got interested in Dia de los Muertos is setting up an ofrenda. Can you tell me about what went into your thought process in terms of A, doing it, and then B, what you wanted as a part of it?
Yeah, you know, the first thing that I did before I built my first ofrenda, which was for my dad, is I actually sought out advice from people who had had this cultural tradition a part of their family tradition for much longer. So I reached out to what we would call our cultural elders. I made my first altar for my dad because that was the most significant loss that I had experienced up until that point. I lost my dad when I was in my early 20s. It was very impactful, losing my father. I didn't really have the tools available to know how to deal with that grief. And what I found in making my first altar for my pops was that it actually was very soothing. It was not just beautiful in like a sentimental way, but it also really allowed me to deal squarely with the fact that that person is gone, but that on this particular set of days, the end of October, beginning of November, I can revisit him in a kind of symbolic way.
Yeah,
where the symbolic kind of encounter that I had with the spirit of my father becomes way beyond symbolic and becomes real. Like I feel like I have a real connection with him. And one of the things I found in my research is that often that is exactly how other people feel in making the ofrenda, that it makes them feel closer to the ones that they've lost, whether or not they truly believe that the spirit of the dead returns. They definitely believe that it activates a memory that makes you feel close to the one that you lost. And that is healing. That is valuable, and that is worth putting the time and effort and money into, like, making an offering for someone who you've lost.
All right, Matthew, thanks so much for the conversation.
Thanks,
I appreciate
Mark.
It.
Yeah.
Matthew Sandoval is a teaching professor at Barrett, the Honors College at ASU, and author of the book Dia de los Muertos, A Chicano Arts Legacy. The related exhibit will be at the Hispanic Research Center at ASU through early December. All right, so Lauren, you've got some trick-or-treaters in your house.
Oh, man, yeah.
What are you going to be digging through their bags for?
I will steal their Twizzlers.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah, and probably a Twix or two.
Ooh.
Like, those might be my faves. What about you?
I love too many of them. That's my problem. So I need to be judicious. I will probably go for maybe like a Tootsie Roll.
Ooh,
or
classic.
My favorite is the peppermint patties.
Oh, man,
chocolate
that is
and peppermint
a real classic.
Together.
Do they still give those out? I want one right now.
I don't
now.
Know if anybody gives them out, but if they do, they're
I'm
probably,
go get them, yeah.
probably going in my belly.
In your belly. And shout out to our wonderful director, Amber Victoria Singer, in there today for the amazing Halloween tunes you've been hearing all hour this hour on
Indeed.
The show.
Indeed. That's it for this episode of The Show Podcast. To find out more about the stories from today, or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.